Nashville Biosciences is leveraging its unique data resources of 2.8 million patient records and their genetic database called BioView to help accelerate the development of new therapies. I'm Duane Schultes, the Managing Director of Vital Transformation, and today I'm speaking to Leland Ekstrom, the CEO of Nashville Biosciences. Good afternoon, Leland.
Good afternoon, Duane. It's great to be here and have this discussion with you.
It's great to be in Nashville. It's a great town. You have a lovely view, I have to say. It's fantastic here in your office. Can you tell me a bit about the history of Nashville Biosciences? I mean, how did it get started?
So the Nash Bio story starts, at least my involvement in it, starts about 3 years ago. I was a consultant with McKinsey & Company at that time. I'd been working a lot in the pharmaceutical space, particularly in genomics, personalized medicine, secondary uses of data. Through some network connections, I had got introduced to some of the folks at Vanderbilt Medical Center in Nashville. Particular resource that they had built up over the past 10 plus years represented a lot of those different trends that I had been working on the consulting side. As you mentioned, we're sitting on top of a large biobank of de-identified medical records and DNA samples. It had been a tremendous resource for the research community here at Vanderbilt, but there was a desire to broaden the impact of those resources beyond just the four walls of the campus, so to speak. It was to provide access to commercial entities, pharmaceutical diagnostics, life science companies who could benefit from that resource.
When you say expand the portfolio and expand the services, what specifically are we talking about? Are we talking biomarker indication for prospective study design? I mean, what are we looking at here?
Yeah, there's a couple of different applications that we've been pursuing based on work that had been done here at Vanderbilt. One of those applications is new indication planning, new indication identification. So using a combination of the genetic data that we've got and the medical record to identify new hypotheses for diseases, side effects, can be done for very early stage drug discovery applications. It can be done all along the R&D pipeline, all the way through to generic repurposing, but it's a way to try and identify new uses for drugs. We've also been doing a lot of work analyzing different patient populations in the medical record. So using that clinical data, whether it's the disease coding, laboratory values, medications, but basically drawing boxes around different patient populations of interest and then analyzing the clinical data. How is their disease progressing? What therapies are being used, looking at cost effectiveness type questions, or some of the work we're exploring with you. Then also analyzing DNA samples for those patients, trying to understand if there's mutations or other things that may be causing those diseases. Looking at other biomarkers or biospecimens, being able to pull proteomic data off of blood plasma, kind of a whole host of different applications. But the basic archetype is drawing a box around a population and analyzing in some way, shape, or form.
Now, this is sort of the magic bag of Felix the cat that everyone's looking for. You know, there's a lot of rhetoric around this space. We're here in Nashville. What I don't think a lot of people in the world would think that Nashville would be a hotbed and actually have these wonderful assets. Why? How did this emerge here?
It's a bit of a, I think if you build it, they will come type of mentality. And I attribute it to, it was obviously well before my involvement here. I've been involved for about 3 years. This effort started 10, 12 years ago, I think it was, shortly after the Human Genome Project was first completed. There was a group of fairly visionary PIs here who thought they could build that type of resource. It was personalized medicine and genomics over time had become a bit of a strategic priority for the medical center. And so there was certainly an impetus to develop that. And in parallel to kind of the growth of that resource, there's a large biomedical informatics group here at the medical center. It's upwards of 70, 80 faculty members. And so I think those two things kind of grew hand in hand. You had an institution willing to support a resource like that, and really it has to be at the institutional level. I don't think a single investigator could grow something of that scale. But then you had a group of investigators who were interested in making use of that. And so it's over time grown to hundreds of different research projects and a broad array of applications. And so then the desire was to, all right, we've kind of got the academic model figured out. How can we take that out to the commercial setting?
So we're currently in what I would call the peak of a hype cycle around real-world evidence. And there's a lot of sky-high rhetoric about this for data discovery and research. How far away is the promise from the rhetoric right now? Are we closing the gap? It sounds like you guys are. But how far is this from the hype and reality?
I mean, we have the we're sitting on a giant database of real world data, right? We're collecting de-identified medical records from across the population of the medical center, which is in the truest sense how is medicine actually being practiced here at Vanderbilt. So we've got the resources to be able to do that. Certainly, it's been as you indicate, it's been a buzzword on the industry side for as long as I've been paying attention to the pharmaceutical space. I think it's merging as these resources become more available and being able to feed, like, to go collect this type of data in a prospective fashion is a very difficult undertaking. So as resources like ours come online and become more aware, it's certainly going to enable those types of studies. I think things like the 21st Century Cures Act last year, another push, so NIH being granted additional money to be able to support this type of study on the pharmaceutical side. That said, I mean, there's still some real challenges in using this data to really really drive this type of application. And what I mean by that, I mean, the question with RWE is really what are the outcomes that come from it? That's really what people try to understand.
What are you looking for? What's the answer you're trying to, what question are you trying to answer,
yeah.
I guess?
And unfortunately, outcomes data is hard to glean from the medical record. It's not most doctors don't check in the medical record, yes, patient responded, no, patient did not respond. So you're having to look at more secondary signs or more inferences, looking at disease progression through different therapy pathways of the therapy use. Potentially biomarkers if there is, but that's a bit of a rare situation. So I think there's still some work on building the tools. Now that we have the raw substrate, are there better ways to get at those kind of outcomes and progression questions? I don't know if you'll ever get physicians to change the practice of the way they're recording information, but that would certainly be the ideal, is to have that box in the medical record. Yes, patient has responded, patient has not. Here's the signs and symptoms that indicated that. But changing physician behavior on that scale, I think, is a much taller task.
Yeah, and also, since most of the work you're doing as well is focused on the clinical trial space, I mean, that gets us to the whole efficacy versus effectiveness question. And do you see a time where we can move away from this rather almost artificial p-value-based statistical analysis over a very short period of time to something that's more longitudinal, that looks at the actual performance across a multitude of patient populations?
Yeah, I was actually just talking with somebody about that type of model, and the type of resource we have here at Vanderbilt actually would enable that, where we're still linked to the medical record. We're working in a de-identified session or de-identified space, but as the patient continues to come in and interact with the medical center, we can follow them over time. So you could see an example where you define a patient population of interest, you look back retrospectively and see what's happened, but then you follow them in the de-identified space over time, and basically it's almost like a running clinical trial, I guess, in that regard, or a running registry. Mm-hmm. You basically set it up on the computational side, and all right, here's the 500 patients to watch. Where do they go? Who do they interact with? What other medications do they come from, or do they develop? And so it would be, it's a two-dimensional observational study, or a forward and backward sort of observational study. So I'm curious to trying to develop that framework further with the right partner and see what you could really glean out of that information.
Well, G.G. Hirsch, obviously at MIT, has been one of the main proponents of this. Hans-Georg Eichler at the European Medicines Agency has been a big proponent of this type of work. Mark Trusheim, also at MIT, who works with G.G. I mean, there are people trying to lead this. What do you think are the barriers to preventing this right now? Is it just ossification? Is it just inertia? What do you think it is?
Partly could be awareness, I think. I mean, the rise of resources that look like us has been slow to come. There are a few. Things like Genomics England, UK Biobank, the Geisinger system up in Pennsylvania are all building these sorts of resources.
CPRD in the UK as well is another one.
But it's getting big enough sets with broad enough coverage of whatever the disease areas of interest is, and then making people aware that these things exist. I think it is a bit of a change in paradigm from how a lot of people think in the R&D space. So it's propagating awareness of these types of resources. Probably the best way is to come up with a really compelling example or two that can demonstrate it, and then...
Yeah, but someone's got to take the first crack.
It's always how do you get the first one out is a fair question.
Yeah, and the problem is, obviously, if you're a clinical trial manager, you know, you've got the potential next $2 or $3 billion asset for a client, and there's a lot of risk aversion because there's a lot of risk,
right.
And it's going to take a very special company and person who's willing to roll the dice.
Yeah, that risk avoidance is certainly something that we see throughout the work we do. the number of news that you try and stack together, new approach, new methods, new technique, new drug, I mean, it just gets to be too much of a, it can be too much of a risk to bear. So
yeah, and the shareholders say no, no, no.
one news, okay, two news, three news, four news.
Yeah, cube news.
Yeah.
So if we're looking at personalized medicine, and you know, obviously when you're dealing with your genomics database and the, you know, exceptional asset that you have, one of the problems that we're seeing is as we personalize, by definition, we're targeting in smaller and smaller populations. And obviously, if we can't come up with some new way to do this quicker with less working capital requirements and less cash burn, you're going to be spreading a $1 billion, $2 billion investment over a smaller and smaller patient pool. It's just there's no other way around it. I guess the first question is, is there some way to change that model? Obviously, we've talked about adaptive pathways. How else are you working to try and help companies or research organizations get around that? And two, is this inevitable that there will have to be change because eventually we'll meet a breaking point?
Yeah, I think that was actually one of the things that got me interested in personalized medicine 7 or 8 years ago at McKinsey. Was thinking the extreme of that is like when you get down to truly personalized care, like
N equals one.
Like, yeah. What is the regulatory structure? What is the, how do you actually regulate a trial?
How do you do a Turum trial with one person?
Yeah, it's and impossible. I mean, we're starting to see some examples of that. I guess the CRISPR therapeutics are an example. CAR T is in some sense a good example of that, where it's getting more and more personalized. You had highlighted adaptive trial design. I think on a broader basis, certainly one dimension, being able to kind of flexibly design and recalibrate a study as you're going. This is where an opportunity like the resources we're sitting on to get to hypotheses more quickly, using the combination of human genetic evidence and clinical data and that bank sense. If we can cut down on some of the basic biology or increase the probability of success for some of these things because you accumulate that evidence before you're actually starting to put those drugs into patients, that would certainly all help reverse some of these trends. But at some point, there may have to be a step change in how the regulatory approach views that. The days of a 10,000 person phase 3 trial,
probably gone.
Harder and harder to see as you get to more and more nuanced disease areas.
You left consulting to take this on. What has been your biggest challenge here at Nashville Biosciences in making this fly?
My time at McKinsey obviously provided a very broad overview in terms of strategy and commercial innovation launch strategy, but less of a focus on implementation and actually getting things done. And I mean, we often joke that the consulting project ends with the Gantt chart, and that's self-evident how the...
Here it is. Good luck.
Exactly. But actually transitioning that to a real live business, I mean, that was has been an incredibly educational experience. And I mean, it's not necessarily the intellectual challenge of some of the stuff I did in my strategy consulting days, but it's keeping track of a large number of people, getting them all on board with the same vision, making sure people are delivering things when they're supposed to. Some of the added challenges of working with working between an academic environment and a commercial environment or what we've had to face here at Vanderbilt, and we joke about it. But yeah, academics do work on their own time and prize their freedom as more than just about anything. So, kind of getting all those pieces moving together and singing to the same tune has probably been one of the biggest challenges. It's also been, I mean, it's incredibly rewarding to see the business emerge out of that though as well. We didn't. When we first started, we didn't really know what form it was going to take. We've already had to pivot a few times in terms of some of the things we can offer and expanding our portfolio of services. And so those have been some of the more rewarding pieces as we go and having to think through new options and new things that we can deliver.
So if people wanted to get in contact with you, Leland, to work with you, how would be the best way to do that and accomplish that?
There's a couple of different ways. Our website, www.nashville.bio, is nice and easy to remember. We're also on Twitter at Nashville Bio, LinkedIn page as well. So any of those three channels, easy enough to get a hold of us. We've launched all those things over the past couple of months, and we're quite proud of the presence we've been able to create. So.
And one final plug, we're working with Nashville Biosciences on a workshop at the DIA International Conference on June 24th in Boston. And we'll be releasing our collaborative research on CAR-T, which is very exciting. And Leland, I'd like to thank thank you for your help.
Great. We're excited to see what comes of it. I think it's it demonstrates the potential of our respective groups and how we'll be able to work together, and we're excited about it.
Fantastic. So thank you, Leland, very much for your time.
Great. Thanks, Dwayne.